Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney, on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Peter Frey, and for my sins, I'm the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at the University of Technology, Sydney. And my producer today is the esteemed Anthony Dockrell. Coming up, in a week where one of the major news items was whether a horse race should be promoted on the side of a public building, which exposed, by the way, the true bullying nature of the broadcaster Alan Jones, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, released a report painting a very, very sobering picture of just what the world faces over the next 10 years if we are going to keep global temperature increases to 1.5 Celsius. It warned that the world only has about a dozen years to keep under that temperature rise or face dire consequences. The problem is, depending on where you get your news from, you either didn't hear much about the IPCC report or had it dismissed as some sort of UN-backed scam. The Prime Minister, by the way, playing to his base, immediately sought to narrow the report down as an attack on the coal industry. God bless him. So what has happened to this country's media's ability to understand, relate to, and produce science news that informs and can be trusted? It's not all about climate change, of course, but science and science journalism seems to be losing out to base politics. Was it always thus, or is it getting worse? Tonight, we will talk about the state of science journalism in Australia. Do we have enough people literate in science in our media? Are we covering science properly? And oh, how do we talk about climate science without turning it into some crazy debate? To help us through all this, we are joined by Robin Williams. What can I say about Robin Williams? Robin Williams is a science journalist and broadcaster with some 43 years' experience broadcasting at the ABC. He is, of course, the host of the science show Occam's Razor, which you can listen to on Radio National, even if Radio National kind of doesn't exist at the ABC anymore. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you so much.
Joining Robin in the studio with me is Alfie Scott, who's from BuzzFeed, who writes about science, is a science journalist, and also a 2SER volunteer. You may have heard her reading the news. She's an excellent news reader, among many things. Hello, Elfie.
Hi, how are you going?
Very well, very well. And joining us on the line from Melbourne, we have Leah Mannix, who is a science reporter for the grand institution called Fairfax Media. Liam was also a finalist in the 2018 Eureka Science Awards for science journalism. Hello, Liam.
G'day, Peter. Thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure. It's wonderful to see you all, and let's get stuck right into it. We'll get to the climate science in a little minute, but first, we are all citizens of the 21st century, so you'd think as consumers of the news, we would all be interested, engaged, and eager for science and more science. However, a quick look at science reporting from our major media players shows that we have very few specialist journalists in science, a great reliance on overseas media providers, and a lot of gee whiz stories such as what food this week prevents cancer? Berries or nuts? I can't remember. Berries or nuts, Robin? What's this week?
I go for nuts.
Nuts, yeah.
Don't worry about the berries.
I always go for the nuts. Anyway, so seeing we've got some of the best in the business on the show tonight, let's talk about the state of science reporting and what can be done to improve how science is covered by the media. Liam, let's start with you. You're a science reporter for Fairfax. Do you have any idea how many actual specialist science reporters there are working on major mastheads?
G'day, Peter. As far as I can tell, I don't think there are many. I think I might be the only full-time employed print science journalist in the country, although I'm happy to be proven wrong if that is the case. And I should also add, Peter, that in fact I wrote an article this week saying that nuts will probably lower your risk of getting cancer. So I'm as guilty of that as anyone.
Yes, well, I read it, and that's probably why I was thinking about nuts. Though, can you write one about berries next week?
So berries is coming up.
Berries, yes, that's okay. So we have this situation where we have Robin and a few other folk at the ABC. We'll get to that in a minute. Elfie carving away in BuzzFeed. And Liam in one of the loneliest jobs on the planet. Against how many people work in the economics or finance desk of the age? Liam, just go over there and count them for me, will you?
Geez, there's certainly plenty of them. There's a lot more of them than there is of me, Peter.
Okay, I guess I'm labouring the point. So, Robin, you've been carrying the science torch at ABC for close to 5 decades. How healthy is science reporting inside the ABC?
It's pretty healthy because we've got a lot of people, maybe temporary, but a lot of people about 20 in TV science. And we have something like the same number in radio plus online and in various parts of the news. If you add them together, it's about 40.
Wow, that's quite an incredible number.
It is, rather. And I think that tells the story because for the last, 50 years I've been doing this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I've been looking at surveys from around the world as to what the most popular subjects happen to be for the general reader, viewer, listener, and so on. Mm. And it's always science and medicine top.
Mm.
And you ask why that is, therefore, that the commercial media don't bother with a science unit.
Yes.
And the answer is because science journalism is a bit like science itself. You have to have a critical mass of people, and you can't just hire them for a few weeks or have a general pool of people and say, you're doing science this week and you're doing police next week and you're doing something like the weather the week after.
You have to have
a critical mass.
Right.
And we've had that for a long time. And the reason that the commercials don't want a critical mass, employing staff for years on end, as you said, I've been there for nearly 50 years. Norman Swan's there for nearly 40 years.
Yes.
And you can't get rid of us.
Well, why would we want to? One answer to that.
Because you grow older and you become less fashionable, perhaps, in the sort of zeitgeist idea of things.
Mm-hmm.
And you prefer having BuzzFeed colleagues like your good self.
Well, over to you, Alfie. Great intro, I would say. Great intro. So, Alfie, how does it feel? You're a sort of critical mass of, almost one, because you're not full-time at BuzzFeed, right? But you're in your second, just about to do your second stint.
Yes.
How does that feel?
You know what? I absolutely love it. I'm the only science journalist for BuzzFeed in Australia, but, you know, they have a team of 7 or 8 over in the US who are constantly supporting me, which is fantastic. But it is funny going into that field and then feeling like, you know, you're trying to carve out a niche. People want to read the content. And I think that's the most surprising part that I've found.
So what do you think is the secret to what's a typically good BuzzFeed science journal yarn? It's about berries again, isn't it?
It's nothing to do with berries.
Oh,
I'm so sorry.
Not even a nut.
May I suggest something that's very interesting that might help? 2 weeks ago, The New Scientist published a survey. In fact, they wrote an editorial about their own survey as to what the public want.
Yep.
And the public wants not just science, but good stuff. They want to know about climate change and some of the bigger ideas, as well as nuts and berries.
Okay.
And they've gone into it very thoroughly, and it puts the lie to the fact that everyone's gone off with the fairies and all they want is floss.
Okay, so
sorry
to back to Alfie, because that's another great intro for Alfie. So what are you writing about? Tell us what floats the BuzzFeed boat.
Honestly, the stories that have gotten the most traction, which I found utterly surprising, were the things that scientists like to talk about. And I thought that was really strange. You know, I'd write things like long pieces about the Stanford prison experiment.
Yep.
A revision of the ethics behind that.
It was a great piece, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yep. But, you know, people genuinely want to read that, which is surprising. It seems like something that would be relegated to academics and people who are interested in cognitive sciences, but that's just not true.
Mm. I think in this there's a theme, there's often a theme in this show, which is that we underestimate our audiences. That's not just about science. Liam, what works for you?
Yeah, I certainly found that surprising coming into science as well. I think I started about a year ago and I was thinking, all right, I'm going to have to do stories that personally perhaps wasn't that invested in, but, you know, animals and venoms and these sort of almost stereotypical science pieces. But I have found a lot of joy with, just like Elfie, higher quality pieces that delve into things that are genuinely interesting to everybody. So this week I was writing about the link between cholesterol and suicide. I had a lot of success with a piece on the science of ergonomics. It has really, really surprised me that people will respond if you give them high-quality stuff that's interesting and that treats them, you know, as adults. And I mean, yeah, it's like Robin says, people actually really care and are really interested in
this. So then answer me this. Why are there only one of you in Fairfax? Why are you the last of the breed?
And look, you breed, I... Yeah, look. Oh, God. What
Where's Marcus
about
Strom
that?
Gone?
He's got the Sydney...
Marcus Strom.
Yeah. Yes.
The wonderful Marcus Strom is now at Sydney University, yeah. Doing a very good job over there. He's greatly missed.
Look, we all know newsrooms have cut back, so maybe it's the science reporters are the first to go. Is that,
well,
is that how
I
you
think
feel?
That, and I let me defend my paper, because I think it's
Please do.
Really
I'm not here to bag your paper, by the way.
I think it's really wonderful that Fairfax make a commitment to science. Mm-hmm. You know, like, to be honest, when we went down, and our last downsizing was significant, as you know, is on the public record.
Yes.
We lost a lot of really good colleagues. Marcus, obviously, Bridie down here. And, you know, I think it was a great show of faith from the paper to say, no, we're still going to give this a go. We're still going to try and do science. And I suppose part of that's on me now to show that we can do science in a way that does drive readers, does drive subscriptions, does drive the news cycle, and is really interesting. So, yeah, no, I mean, it's a tough time for journalism.
Yeah.
But, I think...
Yep.
I back the age, and I think they're doing good in this.
Now, okay. So just having boasted about the ABC, in television, of course, what they went for is the commercial model, and most of the numbers I described, the 20 who are there, there might be one or two managers, and the rest are temporary, and there's the system whereby you come in and pitch your film, and if you get accepted, okay, you might be in the building for a few months if you're lucky, and then you're out. And having people out of the building means that you can, as a person who sits there, like a Hollywood special, a mogul indeed,
mogul.
And you go, oh, yeah, or no,
yes.
And you've got this wonderful sense of power, and
yes.
You don't have to be lumbered with
so
staff.
So are you suggesting then, Robin, that that is a misappropriation of the priorities?
I am, yes. I'll get into trouble now, won't I?
Because, expand on it a little bit.
Well, what you need to do, you're talking about journalism and you're talking about big ideas. And I'll give you an example of some of the big ideas. It was quite amazing a couple of years ago when I went to Washington, D.C. for the announcement at the press club of the discovery of gravitational waves.
Yes.
Now, what the hell are gravitational waves and why should the public care? And why should they have funded it for squillions of dollars for 40 years? And then there was the announcement, and it really blitzed the news everywhere. Because, first of all, they did the announcement well, and you found here's a new way of looking at the universe.
Yep.
And that was perfectly clear to the public because it was explained well, and it was so momentous. It was fantastic. And here you've got something that needs to be handled in a way that requires experience. If you're going to make a television program about it, you can't just summarize it in 3 minutes. You've got to have an application that requires experience, and you've got to be on staff.
And it's also, yes, exactly, I was going to say, you've got to be on staff because a job like that doesn't necessarily come very easily to someone who's on a gig economy trying to work out, got to feed themselves, therefore they've got to do a lot of stories. Okay, let's get to the... back to the beginning, as it were. Let's get to some climate science. So we all know the toxic nature of much of the debate in this country. You know, I often wake up, and I was on a TV show the other night when the IPCC came out, and I kind of left that show going, how did this all get so bad? You know, and I wonder, I'm going to put this back to you, Ron, first, but we'll all get a crack at this one. Has science reporters themselves not done enough to wrest the kind of, if you like, the narrative from the Judith Sloanes of the world, from the political types, from the economic types? I mean, did this is a kind of cruel question, but nonetheless, I think it needs to be asked. Did science journals kind of lose their bottle, Robin?
We didn't lose our bottle. No, we got shouted down, and there's a very big noise machine that makes it look as if there are far more people critical of stuff. I was just looking at some of the papers in the last 2 days. The Australian, Judith Sloan, she says, here we go again, a group of like-minded henny-penny scientists telling us the world is about to be transformed in a bad way unless we act. Yes, we've heard it many times before, and she goes on trashing things. And then Miranda Devine in The Telegraph, turn off the alarm, she says, and says the same sort of thing as the other News Limited papers have done. And today in The Australian, there's Terry Krieg from South Australia writing again that the climate science is a hoax. Mm. It's not partly right or partly wrong. It is a hoax. And what I did a couple of years ago was interview someone called Stefan Lewandowski, who is in Perth. He's now in Bristol. And he did a survey and in conjunction with CSIRO did another survey as to who were the people who were the deniers and were there many of them. And the answer came back clear and loud. They are very few of them, and they're of a particular type, of a right wing of politics, an alternative, alt-right. So hard for me to say these things. But there's so few of them, and they have this immense loudspeaker noise system that is drowning out so many, they give the appearance of being lots in number.
Yes. Alfie, do people who have an alternate view of science, of climate science, deserve a right to be heard?
I don't think it's justifiable anymore. And I barely believe it was. Close the door. It's over. But I think that that's a tendency of journalism in general, isn't it? To try and find the equilibrium in an argument, to try and find something from the opposite side of the fence. And I think that maybe there was the introduction of that argument to begin with, and now that has gained so much of a voice when it is so deeply disproportionate to the amount of research that we're actually seeing.
But also they say the same thing. I've put them on so many times, and it's like certain people in the press writing the same article. I mean, Maurice Newman writes the same article.
Oh, he does.
He used to be chairman of the ABC. Yeah. There it comes again, and we've heard the same old stuff, and when they repeated for the third time, the fourth time, I thought this is enough for the same reason as you just said, Alfie.
Okay, so Liam, let's look at this question in a slightly different way. Is it then the trouble that climate science and this, you know, and the impacts of climate change are long term? If you think 12 years is long term, medium term, and way beyond the political cycle, and therefore they're kind of intangible to the average person. You can't really go and see the impacts of climate science right now. I know you can, but I mean, the average person in the street can't. And that is that the problem from a reporting point of view?
Well, look, I think, Peter, the science journalists around the world for a number of years have actually done a pretty good job on reporting on this issue. We've covered it extensively. There's heaps of copy out there. The Age had, I think, a team of reporters in Kyoto and at the last climate panel. So I don't think the issue has been there. I wonder if this is one of those cases where a group of politicians have worked out that there is a really easy target here, that not that just that they can fight back against action against climate change, but that they can aggressively use it as a tool to win votes.
Yeah, but why is that? I mean, just sorry to interrupt, but why is that? Because if someone said to me, if 220 scientists, whoever it was in the original IPCC, was it more than that, wasn't it? But anyway, hundreds of scientists get together, study the facts and go, hey, look, if we don't do something, we're in deep shit. Then why? Why does it kind of keep, why does that genie keep getting out of the bottle?
Well, people
someone's
don't
failing
like
here.
Being,
a systematic failure is happening.
People don't much like being told what to do or talked down to by experts, do they? I mean, look at Brexit, right? In some sectors has been looked at as people reacting to experts telling them to do something, and they said, well, we're not going to be told what to do by these experts, by these know-it-alls. We're going to do the other thing.
Yeah, but might I just go way back? I actually had, in Science Show number one, which was in 1975, the third interview was about climate change.
Right.
And Lord Ritchie Calder gave the weights of the fossil fuel gases. And he said, we've been saying this since 1963, and here we are in 1975, and people haven't done anything yet. That was 1975.
Right.
Then, if you look at some of the other stories we covered, lead in petrol, which again was up against the fuel industry, and we were called a bunch of communists. Mm. Matt Peacock, when he was doing the asbestos reports, Whit Noon and the criticism of
Ben Hills and Matt and all those people.
Again, the same sort of nonsense happened. Again and again, taking on industry over what seems to be scientific evidence, we have been bludgeoned for one or two decades And then, as with smoking, people eventually say, oh, yes, that's proven.
But and that's a good point, Robin, and Alfie, join in on this, because in a way, despite the noise, and despite the reaction we've seen in the last few days with this latest, you might argue that, you know, in a sense, the climate scientists are winning. It just doesn't feel like they're winning.
Right? I think we're in a turning point.
You think this is a turning point?
Absolutely, yep. It feels like that. But I also will add that I think there are certain elements of the dialogue surrounding climate change that are still just opaque to average readers.
Okay.
I think that continually relying on the idea of the 1.5 degrees Celsius, mm-hmm. that still doesn't feel accessible to most right. people. I mean, what does that really mean? Mm-hmm. And we're talking about global temperatures. Most people wouldn't understand.
Okay, that's great. A great point. So how do you deal with that? Or how could we deal with that?
I think that it's bizarre to me that it hasn't been contextualized more. I think that it's strange that not more people know that there's only, 7 degrees or so between today's temperature and the last ice age.
Mm.
You know, I don't think that has been put into a context that people can really hold on to or understand. It just feels like another statistic again and again and again.
Mm, okay. That's a really interesting point. What do you think about that, Liam?
Yeah, I agree.
Change the narrative. Change the language.
I think the New York Times did the best reporting on this. They do that sort of, here's exactly what it's going to mean for you, and it's going to be really bad, X, Y, Z. But the other thing they do is they give you that long view. They wrote that excellent investigative series this year that said, well, we were at a point, and I think it was in the early 90s, where we almost saved this thing, where we almost had a worldwide agreement to end climate change. And it would have been up there with, the one that took chlorofluorocarbons out of the atmosphere. And we missed it. And since then, we've gotten into this thing and we've knocked over prime ministers and political leaders and the whole thing. I think that's the way to go. You've got to hit people with exactly what's going to happen to them. And then you've got to give them that long view as well and say, this is an impending disaster for humanity. Why aren't we dealing with this?
So how would you cope? Have you had the situation where the news editor or the editor's come up to you and said, hey, mate, this climate science thing is crap, isn't it? Can you write a piece about that?
Luckily, I haven't, Peter, and I wouldn't doubt I would ever be asked to do that.
Possibly. Well, who knows? The age can get tricky sometimes, mate. But anyway, that's another story. One thing that's really interesting about this is that, and I don't think this, just to Robin's point of the tipping point. So people who stand up in public and talk about who are anti-vaxxers, they get slapped down by a wealth of very noisy people, very straight away. AMA and many others come straight in on that. We still don't have that situation with climate denialists. So maybe we're not at that point, because we're not at the same point as anti-vaxxers. Right?
No, but you see, the evidence is really out there. In terms of the 1.5, of course, we're talking about an average there. If you think of the atmosphere of being like an engine and you stoke it up and make it hotter, make it more violent, then you get the consequence. And that's the picture to get. Sometimes it's much, because some people say, 2 degrees, that's the difference between the morning and, later in the day. Big deal? However, think of the engine and it's becoming more and more violent, behaving in a strange way, so that you get more freezing weather sometimes because this machine is being disturbed and you get these winds coming down from the Arctic and freezing, the beast from the east, as they called it, freezing the whole of North America. And then the violent heat that will produce 85 fires on one day in New South Wales in the middle of winter.
Yes.
But if you look at the evidence from the personal point of view, it's hardly looked at in terms of the 2 weeks ago, Lord Stern was on Breakfast talking about what you would gain in terms of the world economy if you prepared effectively for climate change. And the benefit would be $26 trillion. Right. $26 trillion, not 20 bucks off your electricity bill.
Yes, but this goes back to my earlier point about the political cycle.
Look at the number of different jobs.
Yes.
The scientist of the year in Western Australia, Peter Newman, talked on my program about not Silicon Valley, but Lithium Valley.
Right.
And that is a scheme whereby you use the lithium you can dig up in Western Australia and you have new battery technology employing an extra 100,000 people. The good news is out there. That is the basis of the tipping point that's going to make all the difference if only we got through the shouting noise from a certain quarter.
Do you think I'll sit with you, Robin, because, you know, I want Alfie and Liam to have long careers. Do you think it's all about News Limited?
It's a lot about News Limited, yeah.
But why? I don't understand. I don't fully understand the critique of it. It's not as if Rupert Murdoch owns a coal mine.
Well, if you look at Naomi Oreskes' book, Merchants of Doubt, she's the professor of history of philosophy and science at Harvard. She used to be in San Diego. And she talks about a particular new kind of right wing, not the traditional type of right wing we had up to quite recently, that ran with Ronald Reagan's slogan, government is not the answer, government is the problem.
Yes, yes. Yep.
And if you stoke the politics of grievance, now here we are in a very rich country, you're telling everyone they're badly off and they're poor and they're all being got at by some sort of elite. You know, an elite is anyone who belongs to BuzzFeed or
do you think
University
Elon,
of Technology.
Elon Musk is a part of the elite? I mean, what's the...
He's weird.
he's certainly weird. Yeah, okay. No, I hear where you're going. Alfie, what do you think? You know, not necessarily is it all the fault of News Limited, but there is a sort of dichotomy in this reporting. So do you think there's value in a kind of steering, not in a reporting sense, but in a positioning space, to steer the kind of a middle ground to bring people who might be soft right, as it were, to the middle or not?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's hard for me because I read these things constantly. I do feel very radicalized at this point. But I just don't think that we can have a middle ground anymore. I think that we shouldn't shy away from this is not a situation in which we can shy away from hyperbole. This is the greatest existential threat that mankind has ever faced.
Didn't Kevin Rudd say that?
Did somebody say, I feel like Obama said that at the same time.
Well, he used to say it.
May I disagree with you? Because it seems to me if you look to the east, in other words, to New Zealand.
Oh, sorry. I wonder where I was looking for a second.
They, on both sides of politics, Labour and Tory, got together, worked out how a bipartisan system should work, you know, as you would with medicine affecting something to do with your body.
Yep.
Here is a fact or a set of facts, and you discuss it and you apply it because that is what nature is doing.
And that goes, yeah, sure. And just final question to you then, Liam, is this because facts, going back to your comment before about experts, is it because facts now are more contested than they ever were? Or do we have any issues with facts? It's a whole new show, of course, but anyway.
I don't know. I tend to like the argument that Robin and this book advances, but it's not so much about facts, it's about elites. I think there's a great theory about the growing individualization and atomization of society. You know, 20, 30 years ago, we respected experts, we respected government, we respected elites. And now, you know, more and more we're losing that. The internet's allowing everybody to live in their own bubbles and everybody to be their own expert. I wonder if the challenge now is for scientists, because science and scientists have lost some of that ability that they used to have to be able to tell people things and to have them go, yep, I accept that as true.
Yeah, well, that's the biggie, and that is actually a whole new show, I think. But anyway, that's about it from the Fourth Estate. On this subject, I think we could keep going for another 3 hours, but that's not possible because it's radio and things like that. But anyway, I'd like to thank very much our guest tonight. Thank you, Robin Williams, science legend. I'm going to call you a legend. You've been called a legend before. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Robin.
It's a great pleasure.
Alfie Scott, who's at BuzzFeed, and may you have a long and prosperous career. Thank you, Alfie.
Thank you very much.
And joining us on the line from Melbourne, about to go on holiday, have a great holiday, Liam Mannix.
I'm going to. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, mate. And make sure you subscribe to The Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media and a bit of politics and a few things in between at your will. We'll be back very soon with a lot more. But in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Facebook, on Twitter, where our handle is Fourth Estate AU. My name is Peter Frey, and thank you so much for listening.